This is 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk. And big thanks to Patrick O'Sullivan for staying on until 8 o'clock. And we will be doing This Way Out next week. Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, we couldn't get it on today. Again, this is listener-supported radio, 89.5 FM, WPK in Bridgeport. I'm Ebong Udama, and I'll be with you all the way until 10 o'clock this morning. Oh, you see, I'm so used to saying morning this evening. I'm sitting in for Scott Harris, who normally does the Counterpoint program at this time, and I'll be doing it for him this week and next week. We'll be getting into the show in just a little bit, but first, the White Rose political calendar.
The White Rose political calendar is blooming again. After a year's hiatus, this WPKN staple, featuring announcements of area demonstrations, meetings, lectures, films, and boycotts, will soon begin broadcasting again as an important community service. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers its weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles for political and social justice. To include your group's upcoming events in the listings of the White Rose political calendar, send information about national, regional, statewide, and local events at least 2 weeks in advance when possible to whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. That's whiterosewpkn, all one word, @gmail.com. If your event is worth having, you'll want to publicize it on the White Rose.
We have a packed show this evening. We will be starting in just about 10 minutes or so with an interview, an update of the situation in Iran, and with the elections that were held over the weekend and the huge protests that happened in Tehran today. We'll be talking with Robert Naiman, and we'll also be talking with Mohammed Sahimi, and that will be happening in about 10 minutes or so. And then after that we'll be talking with Phyllis Bennis and about the Israeli Prime Minister's key speech that he gave on Sunday. We'll be talking with Phyllis Bennis, and we'll also be talking with Ori Neer, and we'll be doing that in, I believe, about 30 minutes or so. We'll get into that, and then we'll end with an update of the speech that President Obama gave today to the American Medical Association, and we'll have Dr. Aaron Carroll, who will be discussing that with us. But in the meantime, let's have some music, and then we'll get into the interviews. started off with Rock Al Kasbah, Rashid Taha, and this is called Wissal, Chalf Hassan. This is 89.5 FM, WPKN, Bridgeport, and we are going to take a look at developments in Iran following the elections last weekend. And right now we have on the phone line from California, we have Mohammed Sahimi. Good evening, Mohammed.
Thank you for having me in your program.
Okay, great. And also joining us from, I believe, also, I'm not too sure where Robert Nyman is right now. Robert, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm in Washington.
Oh, you're in Washington. Okay, we got Robert Nyman in Washington, and Robert Nyman is a senior policy analyst and national coordinator at Just Foreign Policy, and he recently wrote a piece titled "Based on Terror, Free Tomorrow Poll: Ahmadinejad Victory Was Expected," and also from California, we have Mohammed Sahimi, who's a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California, and he's also written several articles about the election. And I invited both of you to join us today to try and make sense of what is happening. What is your take on what is happening? According to the BBC, the latest from Tehran is that shots have been fired during a massive rally in Iran against last week's presidential election results, with reports saying one person was killed. Hundreds of thousands rallied to support candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi, but a group of them was fired on from a militia base they had surrounded. And Mr. Mousavi has lodged a legal appeal against the result, but says he is not optimistic it will succeed. And he actually appeared at the rally today in central Tehran. And did either one of you get to see any reports on that rally, and could you give us an update?
I have been receiving a steady stream of news from Iran. I have a very extensive network of contacts in Iran because I have university students that I work with in Iran, as well as many of my old college friends who have worked in various reformist administration of President Khatami and other friends. I can confirm that there was one dead in the demonstration in Tehran in support of Mr. Mousavi. So that's the extent I know. We have a political website, TehranBureau.com, where we post all the credible news that we receive from Tehran. And I have also, as you mentioned, written over the past several weeks many articles explaining what the sides are and who supports whom and so on. And since Friday, I have also been updating the latest developments, including an article about what Mr. Mohsen Makhmalbaf, the famed Iranian movie director, who is acting as a spokesman for Mr. Mousavi, in which he explained in detail what had happened on the night of election on Friday night.
So what did happen? Because we got one impression from the news reports that were coming out that there's this massive outpouring of people and probably the largest number of Iranians voting in a presidential election, and so there was the anticipation that there might be some change. What happened?
Maybe your other guest, if he wants to comment on.
Well, the official result, which took many people by surprise, with 85% official turnout, was that incumbent President Ahmadinejad was announced by the Interior Ministry to be the victor in the first round. And many Western observers had expected, first of all, that the election wouldn't be resolved in the first round. There were four candidates. And if no candidate obtained majority, then they had to go to a runoff on the 19th. And secondly, people, as we got closer to the elections, people were starting to think that Mousavi would win. Now, and of course, there have been, in the aftermath of the elections, charges of irregularities and fraud. I think it's important to point out, first of all, that it's extremely difficult, as the Obama administration has pointed out, it's extremely difficult for us in the United States to make any definitive judgment at this stage about the accusations of stealing. It's important to make a distinction between accusations of fraud. It's one thing to say that there was, you know, fraud, cheating, irregularities, people breaking the law. That happens in every presidential election in the United States. What the, is beyond that, though, what people want to know was the result the popular will? And that's what I think is hard for people to judge at this point in the United States. Many people, of course, have already, you know, made their conclusion. They don't like the present government in Iran. They're willing to believe any bad thing about it. So there's an accusation of fraud. People will automatically believe it. And certainly there was irregularities. But because Iran doesn't allow international election observers, there isn't, which would be the normal process for adjudicating such claims. You know, if there were like the 2004 referendum in Venezuela, the opposition charged that there was fraud, the international media can go to the international observers, in this case the Organization of the American States and the Carter Center, to adjudicate the dispute. There's no neutral party here that outside observers or international media can turn to, and also generally the polls in Iran are not considered by Western observers to be very systematic or reliable. They tend to be biased, published by one side or the other, tend not to be random and comprehensive. And there was a poll, as you pointed out, I wrote about this in Huffington Post, there was a poll in mid-May, the 11th through the 20th, by a group called Terror Free Tomorrow. It's a non-governmental organization funded by the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation that's trying to promote diplomacy between the United States and Iran, between the United States and the Muslim world. So they did this study on attitudes of the Iranian electorate, and one of the questions they asked was about the upcoming presidential election. And if you look at those numbers in the middle of May, several weeks, 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks before the election, it showed the incumbent president, President Ahmadinejad, with a substantial lead over his closest challenger, former Prime Minister Mousavi. Now, almost everybody believes that after May 20th, there was a surge for the opposition. But the question in judging what happened is, how big was that? Was it enough to overcome the lead that that poll showed President Ahmadinejad having at that point? And the opposition would have had to have something like 74% of the vote that was then undecided to prevent Ahmadinejad from winning in the first round. Now, I say this not to say, I want to make it very clear, that I'm not saying that the official election results were valid. I'm just saying that people in the United States should reserve judgment till we get more information, knowing that it's very hard for people in the United States to know what's going on in Iran. Obviously, the tensions are very high. People are seeing pictures on TV that, you know, make them angry. But I think that the position that the Obama administration has taken of, you know, keep cool, don't rush to judgment, try not to get entangled. You know, the United States has a very fraught history with Iran in terms of, you know, overthrowing Iranian democracy in 1953. So it's important for at least the United States government to keep very cool in this situation and try to preserve the space for President Obama's promised diplomatic engagement with Iran.
So, Robert Naiman, and this is Robert Naiman, a senior policy analyst and national coordinator at Just Foreign Policy. So basically what you're saying here is that might have been more going on than we were able to perceive, having international reporters converge on Tehran in a week.
Yeah, well, there's a well-known problem, again, because there's a huge difference between data and anecdote and observation. You know, a systematic scientific poll, if conducted correctly, gives you a picture of the opinion of the population. If you're relying on the eyewitness observation of Western observers, then you're going to have a tendency to a certain bias. It's true in Iran, it's true in Venezuela. Because the Western observers are disproportionately, you know, they're going to hang out in North Tehran, they're going to be disproportionately speaking to Iranians who speak English, who are more well-off, who are better educated, and who tend to be perhaps more critical of the government. And in particular, nobody questions that there was a tremendous surge of political activity for the opposition for Mousavi. If you're sort of moving in that crowd, you'd think, wow, you know, the whole country is with us. But that might not actually be where, might not necessarily be where a majority of the population is. Obviously, the incumbent president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, has a lot of support, too, among the poorer Iranians, among more working class Iranians. Again, that's not to say, you know, we don't know if he had a majority that, that remains to be seen. Hopefully, it can be determined. But the fact that, you know, Western observers in Tehran got the impression that, oh, it must be the case that Mousavi is going to win, and if he doesn't, then it must be a fraud. I mean, there are two kinds of arguments. One is actually concrete acts, and the other is just sort of having an assumption, oh, it must be the case that the opposition was going to win, and therefore, if that wasn't the outcome, then there must have been a fraud. And I think it's the second thing that we have to guard against.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mohammad Sahimi, you are an Iranian American. What is your take? I mean, you've been talking with people that you have in the country. What is your take? Is that an accurate, a plausible explanation for what's happened here?
I don't agree with what Mr. Naiman said. If you look at the 2005 elections, the first round, President Ahmadinejad received about 7 million votes in that election. And in that election, there were also four major candidates. Then in the second round of 2005 elections, he received 17 million against 10 million for Mr. Rafsanjani, the former president. But it was widely believed that at that time, a lot of people voted not for President Ahmadinejad, but against Mr. Rafsanjani, who was perceived at that time to be a totally corrupt leader. Now, as Mr. Naiman also pointed out, the surge in rallies for Mr. Mousavi began around May 20th. The polls that he's pointing to, first of all, were taken before that. Secondly, these polls cannot take into account a very solid fact in Iran that 45% of Iran's population is made of ethnic minorities. And in Iran, at least, the ethnic minorities typically vote for one of their own if there is one of their own as a candidate in the election. Now, let's take, for example, the case of Mir Hossein Mousavi. Mir Hossein Mousavi is an Azeri and speaks Turkish. And the Turkish population in Iran make a little over 25% of eligible voters. When he traveled to Azerbaijan provinces for campaign rallies, he was greeted by huge rallies everywhere he went. And every poll that was taken in Iran indicated that over 80% of Azeris would support him. I also do not agree with characterization of Mr. Naiman about the polls that are taken in Iran. There are, in fact, two institutions in Iran that carry out very scientific polls, more or less close to the standards that we have in this country. Those two polls, those two institutions, have taken polls a week before election, last week, and they both indicated that Mr. Mousavi should win the election by about 54% to 23% for Mr. Ahmadinejad. Other polls have taken in the country indicated the same thing. Now, if you look at, for example, the votes that Mr. Karoubi received, it was claimed that he received, and he was the second reformist candidate, it was claimed that he received only 285,000 votes. He was also a candidate in 2005 election, and at that time, after what appeared to be rigging the election on, in the first round, he had received 6.4 million votes. He's an ethnic minority, he's a lower, and he attracts a lot of votes from the lowers and Kurdish area in Iran. Now, not only in principle, he should have preserved those because he hasn't done anything over the past 4 years to distract votes from him, but also a lot of people that had not voted in 2005 and had boycotted, and in particular, a major university student organization had announced their support for Mr. Karoubi. So he was widely expected to increase his vote over 2005 election. And yet, it was announced that he had received less than 1% of the vote, 285,000. Nobody in Iran believes that. There is absolutely no way that this can be accurate, because the lower and Kurdish population in Iran that mostly voted for him make a small but significant fraction of the population. And there is no reason why that population should not vote him for him again, in addition to the fact that millions of people who had boycotted the 2005 elections, major organizations that represented them, had announced their support for candidacy of Mr. Karoubi. So there are all sorts of indications. Now, these are, of course, I agree with Mr. Neyman that we cannot just decide who is going to win based on perception. But there are also other indications that the elections were rigged. For example, according to Mr. Mahmalbaf, the spokesman for Mr. Mousavi, about whom I wrote an article and posted on Tehran Bureau, he said that at 11 o'clock Friday night Tehran time, which means just 1 hour after the end of voting, he took a letter from according to Mr. Mahmoud, but according to his campaign manager, Mr. Abul Fath Fateh, he said that he took a letter from Mr. Mousavi in which he had complained about many irregularities that had been reported to his campaign from all over Iran, and he took the letter to the supreme leader. This was 1 hour after voting had ended. He said that when he arrived at the office of the supreme leader and talked to his representative, the impression that he got was that they thought that the election was already over and Mr. Ahmadinejad was going to be declared the winner. And that was only 1 hour after the end of voting.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, almost at the same time, the Fars News Agency, which is controlled by Iran's Revolutionary Guard, just 1 hour after the end of voting, had announced that President Ahmadinejad had won the election by about 63% of the vote. The president himself, at the same time, these all happened just 1 hour after the end of voting, announced that he had won the presidency with 63% of the vote. So these are all indications that the voting was rigged. And let me ask
you something. Since you're saying the voting was rigged, the experience that we've had with these types of things is that normally we don't have a reversal of the vote. We've had situations like we had in Mexico where, you know, it went on for quite a while, but in the long run, there wasn't a reversal of the vote as it was declared. We had a similar situation in this country where, you know, there was a declaration and it took months of court battles, but in the long run, there wasn't a reversal. What are the chances that we could have a reversal in Iran?
Does Mr. Neyman care to respond?
Well, I think the question is inherently speculative. But there have been some developments already. So let me argue it both ways. On the one hand, under the current system of government, the final authority is Supreme Leader Khamenei, his initial stance after the election was to endorse the result. On the other hand, in the wake of the protests and the complaints and so on, there has been some movement, and Supreme Leader Khamenei has ordered that there be an investigation into the questions and claims about irregularities. In theory, the Guardian Council could not certify the election result. Even former Prime Minister Mousavi has said, although he's asked for this, has said that he doesn't expect it to happen. But it's not an impossible outcome. There is a window, there is a procedure, there is a window for something else to happen. That's number one. There is formally, there's a procedure. And number two, if you look at the political development since the election, there has been some movement by the government not to just say, okay, the story is over. They have ordered that there be an investigation of the irregularity. So it's not totally inconceivable that the result could be overturned, that the election could be reheld, that it could fail to be certified.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert Nyman, you were talking about the reaction of the Obama administration. Would you like to see, Mohamed Sahimi, what would you like to see as the reaction? Robert Nyman has said, you know, he feels that the administration is doing the correct thing right now by being very low key and taking a wait and see attitude. What would you be your suggestion as far as U.S. policy right
now? I completely agree with Mr. Nyman. I think the Obama administration should sit this one out. Anything that the president might say that would sound like he's taking side or he's questioning the legitimacy of the system will play into the hands of the hardliner in Tehran who are looking for any excuse to crack down hard on protesters. So I think the president has taken a very prudent approach. He should sit this one out. There is no reason why the United States should not demand that the true aspiration of Iranian people be addressed, as other leaders around the world have done, but no statement should be made that could be regarded in any sort of way by the hardliners in Tehran that the Obama administration is tilting towards the reformists or questioning the legitimacy of the elections or the system, regardless of whether the elections were actually totally legitimate in terms of the vote counting or not. I think that's a prudent policy to take, and I'm happy that the president has done that so far.
Okay, Robert Nyman, how do you think this contested election is going to affect Ahmadinejad if he does, if the review upholds his victory? How do you think Iranian policy would change, and how much say does he have on Iranian foreign policy?
Well, the last question is the easiest to answer, because there we know that ultimately the key decisions about Iranian foreign policy are not being made by the president. They're being made by the supreme leader. That's not to say that the president has no role or no ability to shape things, but he's the second in command. He's not the first in command. And in fact, on many of the issues, as you know, the Obama administration has acknowledged, while from the point of view of Iranians, it would make a big difference. From the point of view of the United States, U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran, Iranian policy relative to the United States, on the key issues that the U.S. is concerned about is in dispute, there's very little reason to believe that there would be a big change as a result of a change in presidency. On the Iranian nuclear program, there's a broad national consensus in Iran that Iran has the right to enrich uranium. Both candidates pledged that they would not abandon Iran's nuclear program. On the other hand, both presidential candidates said that they support diplomacy with the United States. They're not going to give up the nuclear program, but they support diplomacy with the United States. As the election got closer, the two candidates differentiated themselves more, with Prime Minister Mousavi more, former Prime Minister Mousavi more emphasizing his willingness to engage in his interest in engaging diplomatically in the United States, and President Ahmadinejad less so. But if you look back historically, their positions were pretty close. The international alliances of Iran that are also, you know, a constant complaint of the United States, the relationships in Iraq, the relationships in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and Afghanistan with Hamas and the Palestinians. In broad measure, there's no particular reason to expect a big change in Iranian policy as a result of the change in the presidency. Of course, from a political point of view, it would have been much easier for the Obama administration, even though, of course, it has, you know, has to stay out of these things. But, you know, the day after the election, if former Prime Minister Mousavi had been elected president, obviously, if you're the Obama administration, you're trying to do this sustained diplomatic engagement with Iran, it's easier to have a different face than President Ahmadinejad, who obviously has been a very controversial and polarizing figure with, you know, inflammatory public statements. But fundamentally, the position of the Obama administration has been correct. We're going to, you know, it's not up to us to decide who the Iranian government is. We want to have diplomatic engagement with the government of Iran. No matter who that government is, we'll deal with whatever government emerges. Of course, this particular outcome, in a way, is the worst of all worlds. It would have been easier for the Obama administration to move forward if President Ahmadinejad won re-election in sort of clear, decisive, unquestioned, or not very much questioned result. I mean, 2005, the result was somewhat questioned, but not like today. There wasn't much question internationally that President Ahmadinejad had been elected within the constraints of the Iranian system. Now it's going to be more, there's clearly some kind of hurdle, and these events have to play out before the Obama administration can do anything. But I'm pleased that the Obama administration is playing it relatively low-key, and I'm pleased that the Obama administration is affirming that they're going to continue with their attempts to diplomatically engage Iran, which I think is very important. And I think the fundamental outlines of a deal, of a negotiated settlement on the issues in dispute are not that hard. I mean, it's clear that clear to me that the Bush administration's policy was unrealistic, essentially, you know, insisting that Iran can have no nuclear program at all. This is something unique about Iran in the world. It can't. It's given up its rights to nuclear power. I think it's pretty clear that if the United States will accept Iran's right to enrich uranium, then Iran will agree to some form, and it has in the past, it's likely to agree in the future, some form of intensive, permanent, intrusive inspection regime that protects against diversion of nuclear material, nuclear knowledge to a military program or to proliferation. Similarly, in the case of Afghanistan, the United States and Iran are already cooperating. They already cooperated after 2001 before former President Bush declared them Iran part of the Axis of Evil. In the case of Lebanon, there's already a national unity government that includes the allies of the United States and the allies of Iran, includes Hezbollah and the March 14th movement. And even in the case of Palestine, you know, there was a national unity government of the Palestinians brokered by the Saudis that include Fatah and Hamas, included, again, the U.S. ally and the Iranian ally. I think this is unrealistic over the long term. And it's certainly, I mean, I think every realistic person understands that there's no way to have a meaningful negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians if the Palestinians are split in two pieces. You can't have a peace treaty between Israel and Fatah. It has to be the entire Palestinian political leadership. So, in fact, if the United States is pursuing peace and diplomacy, a two-state solution, it's in our interest, I think, to cooperate with Iran to help bring the Palestinians together, cooperate in Lebanon, to cooperate in Iraq, to cooperate in Afghanistan. I think all these issues can be solved diplomatically. It's not going to be all, you know, immediate and all at once, but they're not unsolvable.
Okay, and that was Robert Nyman, and he's with a senior policy analyst and national coordinator at Just Foreign Policy. And we're also talking with Mohammed Sahimi, who's an Iranian-American. He's a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. And Mohammed Sahimi, you wrote recently a New York Times op-ed in which you compared Iranian election system with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan. With what has happened here, how do you compare the Iranian system to the others?
Well, if the results of the election, as have been announced by the Iranian government, stand and nothing is changed, then the Iranian electoral system obviously will move closer to what we have in Egypt and Jordan, where there is basically, in my opinion and in the opinion of many other people, there is a show of election rather than true election. But I must also say that in Iran, although elections have never been democratic because the candidates are vetted by the Guardian Council, and they have almost never been fair because the ruling establishment always uses the vast resource of the state in support of the establishment candidate. But the elections in Iran have always been competitive. Even the Friday elections were highly competitive in the sense that, first of all, the results are not predictable. They are not fixed. The outcome is not known in advance. And secondly, the contrast between views of the candidates are real. There are contrasting views. There are fundamental differences between the candidates and things of that sort. So that's why I mentioned that the Iranian political system, although not a full democracy, is different from those of other U.S. allies in the region, notably Egypt. Now, let me also mention or comment on whether election of Mir Hossein Mousavi would make any difference to Iran's foreign policy. As Mr. Nyman pointed out, the outlines, the essentials of Iran's foreign policy are actually decided by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, but the president also has an important role to play. Now, if by any chance Mr. Mousavi eventually gets elected, we would see a more flexible, a more rational, a more sober foreign policy by his administration. As we know, President Ahmadinejad has been a highly controversial figure. He has denied Holocaust. He has had rhetoric against Israel. And in fact, that was one of the issues that for which he was highly criticized during the campaign and in one-on-one debate between him and the two reformist candidates. Mr. Mousavi had promised that if he's elected, he will follow a flexible, rational foreign policy. And given what happened during the first reformist president, Mohammad Khatami, one would believe that that would be the case. Now, I should also mention that all Iranian leaders, regardless of where they stand in the political spectrum, defend Iran's fundamental right to having the complete cycle for uranium enrichment and nuclear technology. So that aspect would not have changed. What would have changed would be more flexibility. Just to give you an example, when Mr. Khatami was Iran's president, Iran signed an agreement with the European Union according to which it agreed to abide by the provisions of additional protocol, even though Iranian parliament had not ratified the additional protocol. And it did so for 2 years, and of course it did it on a voluntary basis, until President Ahmadinejad was elected in 2005, and just a few months after that, Iran announced that it would no longer abide by the provisions of additional protocol because it hasn't been ratified by the Iranian parliament, and the Iranian parliament was opposed to its ratification anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of flexibility that we may see in a reformist administration in Iran. Namely, he may agree to more intrusive inspection of Iran's nuclear facility in Iran, a calmer, more sober foreign policy where all the rhetoric and slogans, so to speak, will be removed from the foreign policy, and a rational foreign policy that would protect Iran's national interests might be pursued.
Okay. Another, well, we're running out of time here. We're already 5 minutes over the allotted time for this segment, but I really appreciate both of you joining us and trying to shed a little bit light on what is going on, what we're seeing in Tehran right now. Robert Naiman is a senior policy analyst and national coordinator of Just Foreign Policy in Washington, D.C. And Mohammed Sahimi is a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California and an Iranian-American. And I will be paying close attention to what happens in Tehran. It might give us some clues as to what will happen in the future. And it looks pretty murky right now. Let's hope we have some clarity as to what will happen in Tehran. Thank you, both of you, for joining us. And any final thoughts before we go?
Thank you very much for having me in your program. Let's hope that the situation in Iran is resolved peacefully, and whatever true Iranian aspirations are materialized.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. This is 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk, and we will be back shortly with a look at a speech that was given by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday, yesterday, talking about the situation with the Palestinians in the Middle East. And we will be doing that in just a moment.
قدر بازار میں تن لکھے بٹن تابی دی اجلو سینا بنا سجنی تو ارج کری تو کو سینا بنا سجنی مٹھا ارج کری تو گی دی حیا جنی کے ہو خدا حالب کرے لنے
89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport. That's the music of Musafir, tune called Yad. And we're moving on right now. We're moving to Israel, and we're moving to a speech that was given by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. And according to the BBC, it says that the fact that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu felt it necessary to make a speech at all about a Palestinian state shows that American pressure works. U.S. President Barack Obama has taken every opportunity he can to restate his view that the only chance of Middle Eastern peace lies with the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Had Mr. Netanyahu been prepared to concede the principle of some form of statehood for Palestine, for Palestinians after the Israeli elections in February, he might have emerged with a center-right coalition rather than one dominated by the hard right. But he did not feel he had to until the Americans indicated he should. The Israeli Prime Minister's body language suggests that he was doing it under diplomatic duress. We're now joined by Ori Neer, and he's with the group Americans for Peace Now. And I'd like to find out from you, Ori, what did you make of Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech yesterday?
Well, first of all, thank you, and it's good to be on your show. I think that it was best put by an Israeli Knesset member today, who said that Netanyahu's speech was a teeny tiny yes, followed by an enormous but. It sounds not as funny in Hebrew as it is in English, but I think that pretty much sums it up. In other words, what he tried to do was to say yes to a Palestinian state, and that is a leap for him. So it was a great leap for Benjamin Netanyahu, but a very small step for the peace process. The peace process is not benefiting much from his final acceptance of the concept of a Palestinian state, simply because the notion that a Palestinian state is a must, not only for future stable Middle East, but for the future of Israel, for the future of a safe, democratic Jewish state of Israel. That notion has been a matter of consensus in the international community, and a matter supported by a large majority in Israeli society. So Netanyahu's coming around to accept this principle is a very big deal for him, but it's not such a big deal for the peace process, both because of what I just said and because he posed so many conditions to the actual eventual creation of a Palestinian state.
Well, the reaction from the White House and from President Obama himself, he welcomes the speech and says it's started us moving in the right direction. Do you think that that is the attitude to take the proper attitude for the White House to take?
For the White House, it is. By the way, my group in a press release that I drafted yesterday also welcomed the step. It welcomed Netanyahu's endorsement. I don't know if endorsement, but acceptance of a Palestinian state.
But hadn't he done this before during the Oslo Accords? Wasn't he part of? He wasn't part of the Oslo.
No. He was not. He was in the opposition at the time. He was.
But when he became prime minister in the late 90s. Did he not ascribe to a Palestinian state?
No, he did not. In fact, Netanyahu was the Israeli politician who, maybe more than anyone else, embodied the opposition to a Palestinian state in various articles that he wrote and so on. His argument for many years has been that a Palestinian state could not be demilitarized, could not be a threat on Israel, an actual existential threat to Israel, and therefore, because of that, because there is no way to guarantee that it would not be a threat to Israel, any Palestinian state would not be viable, and therefore is not advisable for Israel. So he has been a staunch opponent of the creation of a Palestinian state. Today, yesterday in his speech and today in briefings, Netanyahu actually said that it is possible to have international mechanisms that would ensure that a Palestinian state would not be armed and therefore would not be a threat, a security threat to the state of Israel. And that is a big change for him. So it is a change.
Okay, this is 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport, and 88.7 FM, WPKM Montauk. And I'm Ebong Udama. I'm sitting in for Scott Harris this Monday on Counterpoint. And right now we're talking about a speech that was made yesterday by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, talking about the situation with the Palestinians, and the major news headline that came out of that was that rather reluctantly, I believe, he accepted that there would be a Palestinian state after, you know, decades of opposition to having a Palestinian state. So the reaction from President Obama today was that basically he's pleased that the Israeli Prime Minister has talked about has endorsed Palestinian independence and shows the possibility that we can restart serious talks. Now, are we going to have some serious talks now? Because there have been people who have complained that the Obama administration is leaning heavily on Israel and not demanding much of the Palestinians. Orinia, what would be your reaction to that? I mean, what is needed to get this process moving again?
In order to have serious talks, one needs, I think, three main, or there are several components that are needed. First and foremost, and this is where the great hope is now for organizations such as mine, Americans for Peace Now, who support Israeli-Palestinian peace, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, that component which has been absent from the process for many years is the strong, determined leadership by an American president with the actual personal involvement of an American president. And we do see that with President Obama. We haven't seen that in the past 8 years with President Bush. So that is a big change, that is a very promising change, and that is one component that is there and is very promising. The other component that we need is strong leaders in the region. We did not have that in the past years. We had an Israeli prime minister who was bleeding support because he was involved with all sorts of alleged corruption scandals. We have still a Palestinian president who is not strong, and we have a Palestinian leadership that is split between Fatah and Hamas, between the West Bank and Gaza. So that still has to be somehow enhanced. In other words, the component of the Palestinian and Israeli leadership, and maybe could be compensated for by the strong involvement of the U.S. administration. The third important component, and that is something that the U.S. administration could work on and can put pressure in order to obtain, is the creation of an atmosphere of circumstances in the region that are conducive to successful peace negotiations. Mainly, the dramatic reduction of the level of violence, particularly coming from the Palestinians. That is something that we've actually seen in recent months There has been a reduction in Palestinian violence, a reduction in incitement to violence on both sides and in expressions of hatred, and very importantly, coming from Israel, a total freeze and comprehensive freeze of settlement activity in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and the removal of illegal outposts, settlement outposts from the West Bank. Without those steps, any kind of a negotiating process would not be credible in the eyes of Israelis and Palestinians.
So, okay, now we have this. We had the meeting with the president had with both the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and with the Benjamin Netanyahu in the White House. We've now had the speech by Mr. Netanyahu yesterday in Israel. What is the next step here? How do we move forward?
What I think is the next step is an attempt to put together, and this is what I think Senator Mitchell is trying to put together in the region, George Mitchell, the special envoy, the president's envoy to the Middle East, and that is a series of negotiations to try to both revive the negotiations between Israel and Syria, Israel and Lebanon, and Israel and the Palestinians, and all that supported by Arab governments who will reactivate their peace initiative of 2002. Yeah. I think that this president is trying to introduce a new approach to the negotiations, maybe not that new because there have been others who tried it before, but new in comparison to the past 8 years, of which is a comprehensive approach that tries to leverage the whole Arab world to the success of the negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians.
Now, what we used to have in the past were the hardliners in Israel would look for something to try and derail whatever track the negotiations were on, or we would have Hamas or some other group in on the Palestinian side that would carry out some type of attack and would try to derail. So you had a situation where not every party to this conflict was at the table, and those that were not at the table were trying to disrupt, you know, anything that would come out of the negotiations. How do we? Has that changed? I mean, how do we?
Well, no, I don't think that has changed, and that is one of the main that is the Achilles heel of the whole peace process. Time and time again, we've seen in the past that the militants have the power, have the veto power, to basically bring negotiations to a halt as a result of violence. And we will see more of that, I think. It may be less so coming from the Palestinians just because of the situation Hamas is under in the West Bank, where it's being held under wraps both by Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and because Hamas doesn't have much of an ability to wage effective terrorism out of Gaza. I think that's what we will see quite a bit of, particularly if Netanyahu carries on with the removal of settlement outposts, the illegal outposts in the West Bank, is more attempts by the militant settlers in the West Bank, the Jewish settlers there, to react with anti-Palestinian violence with an attempt to derail the peace talks. That is a weakness of the peace negotiations. And, you know, in the past there were situations, there were instances, particularly with the Rabin-Peres government in the mid-90s, where Israeli leaders said, we will continue fighting terrorism as if there are no negotiations, and we will continue negotiating as if there's no terrorism. That is something that I cannot see Prime Minister Netanyahu doing. It is not a part of his philosophy, of his worldview, and that worries me very much.
And now we do have a situation here where the parties are reluctant, and it will take a lot of patience to get anything done. Are you saying here that if For instance, there's an attack on Israel as the talks are going on, that might be a reason for Netanyahu not to continue? And how does that, you know, the other thing that I don't understand is how he maintains his coalition that he has cobbled together, that took him quite a while to be able to cobble together. How does he maintain that coalition and get that coalition to be behind any new policies that might be the result of this, of these negotiations?
Coalitions in Israel usually are more stable than people think they are. They can sustain more than people believe, and I think that this is the case with this coalition as well. Look, yesterday Netanyahu gave a speech in which he talked about the Palestinian state. The right flank in his coalition did not like it. Several of the members of this flank are cabinet members. There are ministers in his government. They didn't like it. They cried foul, but they're not dismantling the coalition. So, and the reason is that people want to be in power. People simply want to maintain their position in power. So, in terms of keeping his coalition, I think that he could keep the coalition and continue negotiating. The problem will come when the negotiations will become substantial, and then two things could happen. One would be that there would be enough of an incentive for even the members of this coalition to keep the coalition intact while negotiations are going on, because the payback, the compensation for whatever concessions need to be made would be large. Particularly what I'm talking about is some kind of an offer coming from the Arab world for a beginning of normalization, of normalizing relations with Israel. Another scenario would be at a certain point, a certain tipping point in the negotiations, when the right wing in Netanyahu's coalition cannot stomach it anymore, where that flank will leave, and then Netanyahu will probably be in a pretty good position to broaden his coalition with the Kadima party.
Did a similar thing not happen and lead to Ariel Sharon forming Kadima in the first place?
Yes.
It was a similar situation.
You're right,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. So that could happen. It could happen, and then you would have some kind of a national unity government in Israel, which would be viewed by all, I think, as having the mandate. At least politically, there would be some people who would say that they don't have the moral mandate, but politically they would have the mandate to reach a comprehensive deal and to make the kind of concessions that are needed. A third scenario, by the way, could be the collapse of the Netanyahu coalition and early elections. We've seen that happen before as well. I think that out of the last five governments in Israel, in other words, none of the last five governments in Israel actually completed its term, its four-year term, but had to go to new elections before that term was up. So that could very well happen as well.
How does the situation in Iran play into the take of the Israeli government on the pace at which they want to get into these negotiations?
The situation with Iran plays a very important role, and it's a role that is difficult to quantify and is difficult even to characterize, because it works in various different directions. The most important thing to understand is that Israelis genuinely are, really are, very, very concerned, if not more than that, of the specter of a nuclear Iran. Israelis view that as a true existential threat, something in the magnitude of a new Holocaust. They're hearing and seeing an Iranian leader who is now reelected, who talks about annihilating Israel, and they see him trying to, you know, acquiring the missiles that could reach Israel, and trying to arm them with warheads that would do the job. So the Israeli fear, whether it's grounded in reality, whether it's I think is very, very important to understand. And from there, you can see how various politicians are using or are playing on that kind of fear. Some of them are actually playing the politics of fear, and we actually saw that coming from Netanyahu's camp in droves during the campaign before the elections in February. And what we see coming from the other side is the argument that I find very compelling, which is that, which the same argument that President Obama is making, by the way, which is that a peaceful Middle East, peace between Israelis and Palestinians and their other neighbors, would make it that more that less difficult, let's say, to deal with an Iran that is trying to acquire nuclear weapons. And that, I think, is a very compelling argument. I cannot say that that is the winning argument today in the Israeli public. I think that Israelis are more guarded, and in other words, the situation with Iran is working more to empower and legitimize the right-wing hardline leaders. And that may have been one of the main, if not the main, reason for the success in the elections of Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically, looking forward, are you optimistic or pessimistic? What's the attitude of the Americans for peace now? I know that you're striving for some type of peace deal, but are you optimistic that, you know, considering the lay of the land right now?
I always say that I'm hopeful. It's hard to be optimistic because when you look at the circumstances in the region, it's interesting. I was in Israel about a month ago, and I came back hopeful as always, but very pessimistic, I have to say. When you look at the situation there, at the leaderships that are weak, at the division between West Bank and Gaza, Fatah and Hamas, the lack of ability on the Palestinian side to reach unity, the apathy on the Israeli streets. Israelis are apathetic. They don't really care about the conflict anymore. There are many, many reasons to be pessimistic when you come back from there. However, when you're here in Washington, which is where I am calling from and where my organization is headquartered, it is hard to not be hopeful and inspired by the new atmosphere, the new energy that we have in the Capitol here, of a real attempt to try to push for Middle East peace. This administration really is serious, and they're getting the backing they need from Capitol Hill so far, and they're not getting the pushback that they used to get in the past from the conservative Jewish community. So the view from Washington is inspiring and really, you know, fills you with hope. It has to be taken, although, with a great deal of skepticism, unfortunately, and guardedness, because the situation in the region still is very difficult.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ori Ner. He is with Americans for Peace Now, and they're a group that has been working for some type of a settlement of the situation between the Palestinians and not some type. You have a specific goal.
We stand for a two-state solution. We've been there much before this formula became popular and the matter of the consensus. So very much in favor of the creation of a Palestinian state, both for the Palestinians and for the sake of a secure, democratic Jewish Israel.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ori Ner, and thanks for joining us this evening. We will be back shortly with a look at a speech that President Obama gave today to the American Medical Association, and we will get reaction from Dr. Aaron Carroll. who has been critical of the AMA, and we will be doing that shortly in the next couple of minutes. Stay right by your radio. This is 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM, WPKM Montauk. Minutes after the hour of 9, this is 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM, WPKM Montauk. And now we move on to the next topic, Obama's speech, the President Obama's speech before the American Medical Association in Chicago today. According to this BBC report, U.S. President Barack Obama has told a meeting of doctors that spiraling healthcare costs could bankrupt the American economy. The U.S. could go the way of General Motors unless the health system is reformed, Mr. Obama said at the American Medical Association annual meeting. Doctors, along with other groups, are divided over Mr. Obama's proposals. Health reform was one of Mr. Obama's key election promises, and nearly 50 million people are without medical insurance. Mr. Obama is proposing a 10-year reform program estimated to cost about $1 trillion that would make healthcare available to all Americans. And right now, we're joined on the phone by Dr. Aaron Carroll is on the phone line, and he's joining us. And were you able to see the president's speech?
I watched it today.
Okay. What did you make of Mr. Obama's speech?
I'm not sure he said much in the way of anything new, but by coming, I think, and speaking to the AMA, he's trying to do, I think, what he's done when he goes to Cairo to speak to the Muslim world, when he goes to other places. He's trying to sort of reach across to the groups that have normally been opposed to the things he's trying to get done and actually try to engage them. And I think
Dr. Aaron Carroll, there's a buzz on this phone line. Mind if we try and reach you again, and maybe we can get a cleaner line?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll call Dr. Carroll right back. Stay right by your radio, 203-384-9756. Okay, we have Dr. Carroll back on the line, and we still have that hum going. Maybe it's from the board. I'm going to try and fix, make sure. Okay, well, we will have to, we could do this. Maybe we will try and bring you up on another part and... Hello?
Yes.
Yes, it's still, I'm still getting a hum, and I am not too sure where it's coming from.
Okay.
But let's go ahead.
Okay.
Now, you said you had watched the president's speech today.
Yes.
And you were talking about the fact that there wasn't much new in what he said. It was more the setting in which he said it.
Yes, I think he's trying to engage the AMA, which in the past has been a vocal opposition to any kind of health care reform, and indeed they fought sort of every major step of health care reform in the last 50, 60, 70 years. So I think he's making a good faith effort to try to engage the AMA so that they won't perhaps be so much in opposition this time around.
Now, he did get some booze there was when he talked about medical malpractice, it didn't go down too well in the room.
Well, I think the fact that he actually talked about it at all is a significant step. I'm not sure if you've had any Democratic presidents in the last 30 years, maybe even more, who've actually discussed malpractice reform, so the fact that he's discussing it at all, I think, makes the AMA happy. He's not going to give them what they want in terms of sort of capping punitive damages and everything else, but he at least is trying to engage them on the idea that we need to protect physicians from frivolous lawsuits, in essence, to stop some of the defensive medicine practices. And for that, I think he should be applauded.
Now, the AMA's position on is against a government-backed insurance alternative insurance program, and you conducted a survey. You did a poll of doctors, and found that 59% of U.S. physicians favor some type of national insurance. Is it a national insurance for everybody, or as Obama, the president, is saying, something to compete with private insurance?
Well, we've over the years tried to sort of poll American physicians in very, very large national surveys to try to actually get some scientific data on what they actually believe, instead of listening to, you know, sort of talking heads say what they believe. And so our last survey was done about a year ago, and we surveyed over 2,000 physicians nationwide and asked them if they would support government legislation for national health insurance, which, you're correct, will be far more radical reform than what President Obama is proposing. National health insurance would be, to some extent, something like Medicare for everyone, or a single-payer system where all care is financed by the government. That's far more than anyone is proposing, and we found that 59% of physicians would support that. So there's no reason to believe that there's not a significant majority of physicians that would support at least the public option that President Obama is pushing forward right now.
Okay, but what is the complaint? Why are doctors in the AMA, why are they concerned about having a, that it would affect the fees that they receive?
Well, there's a whole host of reasons the AMA might oppose it. One is that the AMA makes a significant amount of its money from business relationships with industry, by selling insurance, actually, to its members through other financial ties it has through actual industry. And so there's a financial tie that the AMA would seek to lose if people moved to more public options or private insurance went away. Another reason is that public insurance in the past, in the form of Medicaid and Medicare, has been a bone of contention with respect to reimbursement rates for some physicians, especially in the surgical subspecialties and some of the high income areas of the doctors practice in. And so there's concern amongst those specialties, perhaps, that movement towards a more public system could reduce in less income. However, there's no reason to believe that the vast majority of physicians feel that way. The AMA is not necessarily representative of all physicians. Indeed, its membership is skewed towards sort of older surgical subspecialists or the physicians who actually make more money. And so therefore, yes, the AMA may be concerned, but that does not necessarily mean that physicians as a whole are equally concerned.
Okay, now, having universal health care, which is what the goal is here, How would that affect the work of physicians if everyone was covered in this country?
It shouldn't affect them at all. This is sort of the bizarre thing about it, is that we're talking about health insurance. We're talking about the way that healthcare is financed, and that's just pushing money around. No one is proposing a system where the government would run healthcare. No one's proposing a system where the government would employ physicians or run the hospitals or make the decisions. They're just talking about the insurance. Indeed, the only sort of public plans that we have in this country, the biggest being Medicare, which is really socialized finance healthcare, that's what Medicare is, the government is just paying the bills. You know, you still go to your private doctor, you still go to any hospital that you want, you still have choice of physician or practitioner or anything else. It's just the government's paying the bills. And that's at most what a public option would be. It would just be that instead of billing Blue Cross and Blue Shield for your care, you'd be billing a government agency for your care. It shouldn't change the way that physicians are practicing at all.
Okay. Now, what do you make of the process itself as it makes its way through Congress? Do you feel that we're doing it the right way this time? Do you feel confident that we're going to end up with something that moves the ball forward?
You know, I've been real pessimist over the last decade, but I actually feel more optimistic right now than I have in a long time. I think that we will likely wind up with healthcare reform that actually is different than it has been, especially if they manage to push the public option through. I don't think it will be as cheap as people hope it will be. I think because we'll still be relying on a very fragmented system, it's going to be more expensive than people think. I also think it's going to take some time before we see any of the real changes in quality that everybody's proposing, but at least getting the significant majority of Americans covered would be a nice first step, and I actually think that we're probably going to get some significant health care reform passed.
Okay, and as far as physicians are concerned and the physicians you're talking to, what is their number one concern as you do these surveys?
You know, that's not technically, I think, what we've been addressing, so it's hard for me to sort of say with any kind of scientific accuracy, but I think there's a general sense amongst physicians. You know, people are frustrated. You know, physicians are human beings, and they're Americans just like everyone else, and their health care is just as, you know, fragmented and difficult as everyone else's is. You know, it's a difficult system. It's frustrating for a lot of people to practice. The incentives aren't properly aligned to sort of achieve the best quality. And I think the fact that, you know, 59% of physicians would be willing to go to a national health insurance system points to the fact that really we're as upset as everybody else and really ready for some significant major change. And I think that, you know, the AMA may try to provide some opposition this time around, but I don't think it's going to be as vocal as in the past. And I think that we're just as frustrated with the healthcare system and the insurance market as everybody else is.
And basically the trend in your polls has been increasing numbers have been accepting the fact that we should have some type of universal healthcare.
Absolutely. Sort of. We did this poll 5 years apart, and we found that in every single specialty that we measured in both years, support for national health insurance increased in every single specialty. And at this point, a majority of every single specialty, with the exception of surgical subspecialists, anesthesiologists, and radiologists, now favor would support government legislation for national health insurance. That's remarkable. I mean, they, you know, to see a majority of general surgeons, of ER physicians, of medical subspecialists, of all the other specialties, a majority of physicians would support even the radical reform of national health insurance. Knowing that, it's very difficult to say physicians would be opposed to what the administration is pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the process is going to unfold in the coming weeks. We're told that by the end of the summer there should be a bill, and we look forward to seeing what emerges. And you have said that you're tending to be more optimistic than you used to be about.
I am. I think you've seen a number of the forces against healthcare reform make major concessions in the last year. This includes the insurance industry, as I said today. You know, the AMA, I think, is not nearly as united in opposition as it has in the past, and I think that we have a Congress, which is an American public, and a president who are all sort of united really for healthcare reform and very open about it. You're not seeing a lot of backdoor behind, you know, behind the scenes negotiations. Everybody's debating the different facets up front. We all know what we're getting up front, and you're not seeing a lot of opposition. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to fight, but I don't think that there are going to be any huge surprises coming out of the woodwork in the next month and a half, and I think, therefore, it's very likely that they're going to get something passed.
Yes, Dr. Aaron Carroll is the lead author of a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine on doctors' views on a national health program. And we will be following this in the coming weeks, and I know you will too. So maybe we will talk with you again, Dr. Carroll, as this progresses. And thank you very much for joining us this evening. And giving it, so basically, you feel it's a positive, we're in positive territory right now.
I do, and okay. You know, again, I've been very pessimistic in the past, so I think that there is a good chance that something real will happen.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Carroll, and have a good evening.
You too, thank you.
Okay, this is 89.5 FM, WPKN, Bridgeport. I'm Ebong Udama, and I'm sitting in for Scott Harris, who normally does counterpoints at this time. I am doing it this week and next week. So next week we hope we'll have some more topics to deal with in the news. And right now we will have some music, and we'll open up the phone lines, and maybe you might want to share some of your thoughts with what is happening right now. And in the meantime, we will have some music. If you want to call, the number is 203-336-9756. And you could also share some issues that you think we should deal with here. This is listener-supported community radio, 89.5 FM, WPKN, Bridgeport.
molokua okunwa nile oke walonga ile wombo lokua oke arere
okun belele da pego okun belele
I'm
Thank you.
tune is Abracadabra. Gabriella Anders, and before that, Ogunbelele, Colette Michan. Started off with Miss Know It All, the original version by Scientists. Minutes before the hour of 10, 89.5 FM, WPKN, Bridgeport. And Nazma will be in at 10 o'clock, I believe, taking you all the way until 2 a.m. But before I go, I'm going to play these two cuts. The original Raga, Eccentric Sound System. Okay, that's the original Raga, Eccentric Sound System. And I will be with you again next Monday night, 8 p.m. until 10, doing Counterpoint, sitting in for the regular host of this program, Scott Harris, who's away for the next couple of weeks. And I shall see you Monday. Monday next week, of course, but I'll see you on Wednesday morning right here. Leaving you with this one. It's called If I Needed Someone, Madhu. And I believe coming up next will be Nazmo. Nazmo's come. No, John! John, I'm sorry. I saw Nazmo in here first.
Nobody ever remembers that this is my show.
Okay. John Lazar is going to be taking over. Is it John Lazar, John Laser? Okay, he's coming up next. John will be on in the next 4 minutes or so. I had a good time. Pardon? Yeah. Yeah. That's Nasbo. Okay, this is Listeners Supported Community Radio 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM, WPKN Montauk. Oh, if I needed someone. Artist is Madu, If I Needed Someone. Okay, have a good night, and I'll catch you next time right here at 89.5 FM.
If I needed someone to love, you're the one that I'd be thinking of. If I needed someone,
physics. Then everyone wonders why 17 other countries graduate more scientists than we do. Education! Politicians know that word. They use it on you. Politicians have traditionally hidden behind three things. The flag, the Bible, and children. No child left behind. No child left behind. Oh, really? Well, it wasn't long ago you were talking about giving kids a head start. Head start, left behind. Someone's losing fucking ground here. But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks. And it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The big, the wealthy, the real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're an irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media news, all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. Nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hard-working people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hard-working people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it. But say what you want about American folks. Yeah. You can say what you want about Americans. You can call them smart, dumb, ignorant, innocent, naive, gullible, easily led, whatever you want. You're going to have to deal with them. You're going to have to deal with them because you're in the television business now. You got the all-suicide channel on cable TV. You need these people as viewers. You need people looking in. You got to worry about your ratings. You're going to have to be thinking about sweeps months.
Okay, and that was George Carlin, and commenting on the state of education and the state of the sheeple here in the United States. And we'll be going back and forth with Mr. Carlin all evening. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WPKM 88.7 FM in Montauk, New York, and on the internet at www.wpkn.org. Hi, I'm John Laser. This is still a show with no name, and joining me this evening is Nasmo King.
Hello.
And this evening, in addition to Mr. Carlin, I've gone out and I've dug up, maybe about an hour's worth of music. by two of my favorite artists. First one will be Mr. Springsteen, followed by Billy Joel.
Oh, and no Gordon Lightfoot.
That'll come later, too. Okay. I said two.
No Jimmy Buffett.
Maybe later after okay. that. But the idea behind the Bruce and the Billy is that they are songs you probably never heard them sing before, or versions of songs that you've probably never heard before.
Ah.
So we'll be doing that. So,
you know, Billy's an Islander from Hicksville.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we have the demo version of Piano Man, for instance.
Ooh.
Yeah. And we got a lot of stuff that he released a couple of years ago on My Life's set of four CDs.
I like him when he does the interview with the Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
He's quite comical and stuff. He kept on, you know, going out of his chair and reading the piano and back from the piano to his chair and stuff like that. And it was quite good.
Well, and then the Springsteen stuff is all done with acoustic.
Is this from Dublin?
Yeah, it is.
Ah, okay.
So there's some Dublin stuff. I realized that I play Mrs. McGrath quite a bit, so I cut that out of the playlist.
Everybody seems to call up and ask for last Friday when you were playing that from 7 to 8.
Or who was doing Mrs. McGrath? Maybe I'll sneak that in anyway.
Now
you got me. We'll start with that. Let me.
Do we have an F1 report coming up?
We sort of do. I'll give you, while I'm finding this, I'll give you the F1 report. So, no surprise, Jenson Button won in Turkey last weekend. Number 2 and 3 was Red Bull, and that was Mark Webber and Sebastian Vettel. So, the two Red Bulls are took 2nd and 3rd. So, about the only real contest on the books at the moment that's of any interest will be the Constructors. The Constructors Series, and the Constructors Series, obviously, Braun is pretty far ahead. I forgot what it was. The Red Bull folks are about halfway behind them.
Ah, well,
so there's a 30-point gap between them. But that's not insurmountable. And the Constructors, it looks like Red Bull can actually challenge Braun for a Constructors title this year, but that's about it. The other thing that you were interested in is, or what our listeners may be interested in, what's going on next year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Ferrari's kind of in, but they have a demand statement. Williams is in, but they have a pact with somebody else.
No, so here's the deal.
And Ferrari's being a prick.
Two teams, Force India and Williams, are bound by contractual obligations to